about the law.
Murphy's Law Podcast, your host, Ian Murphy.
And I'm just like,
this is hard for him to hold back.
So much I want to share.
Remove all the emotion from all of this stuff.
And they never wanted this to happen to the citizens again.
We never stop growing as an individual. Right. So.
All right. Welcome to this week's episode of Murphy's Law. With me again, my good buddy, Chris Kuhn. We got a couple of things that we want to talk about. We may cram it into a one or two or three parts, maybe split it up over a couple episodes. But
man, we have a lot.
We have a couple of things that we wanted to dive into. It seems like every 2-3 days we get a new filing of some sort. Something that has to do with our case, and we kind of can't get these episodes out fast enough.
No, and the head scratchers just keep coming. I mean, it's literally, it's been... I mean, right now we probably have a week's worth of content that we can go over, because like day by day, there's more head scratches coming out.
It's tough not to get too in the weeds on some of these things without being really boring. You know, neither of us are attorneys, so we try and boil this stuff down into things that kind of make sense. And again, you know, we may not pronounce some of these things right, and we might get some of these things wrong, but, you know, this is where we flash the disclaimer that, you know, we're not attorneys, and if you take us as it, you're probably foolish.
Yeah, shame on you. I mean, really.
Shame.
Shame. But, so, like, to look at the thickness of the stuff that's come out, and that's only part of it.
I mean, I've got stacks over here that you guys can't see. And
we'll get in detail. What was the one brief, or the, like, 115 pages?
The last one was Nestle's motion that they included 4 other cases that they submitted to the Supreme Court. 146 pages altogether.
146 pages.
Yeah.
Taxpayer money spent at its best.
Yeah, I think the largest one we've had so far is 180, 182, something like that. And of course, you know, it comes through the mail, so it's, you know, $1, $2 just to mail the damn thing.
Well, and you know, and a lot of what we're going to talk about coming up here too, it really has nothing to do with the Iron Pigs lawsuit. It's more a matter of, it really just kind of has a scratch in your head thinking, what the hell?
It is. It's adjacent. Our case is embedded in at least one of these cases that is involved in Nestle's recent filing with the Supreme Court. One of them, our attorney, is representing a group of parents down in the Comstock public school area.
Which we just talked about in the last episode, actually.
Yeah. You know, before we get into this too much, every time we do this, we've kind of moved down here into the restaurant. We jokingly call this Studio B. This is kind of our favorite place to be. It's a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more casual.
It is, and you know, closer to the bar. Nice that some of the patrons can come check it out.
Every time we do an episode, though, we kind of throw out, I'm a movie fan, so we always try and throw out some kind of movie quote that might be somewhat related to what we do on the podcast. Of course, we've got Dashboard Jesus, if you can see. And, he's always hanging out with us, you know, keep
Jesus
us on the path.
The shit out of you.
And, of course, we always have the 2253 unconstitutional poster back there, so... just some of the stuff we enjoy throwing in each one of the podcasts that we do here. So going into this Comstock case, it has taken some interesting twists and turns, and we don't want to get too muddied down, but the reason why I wanted to shed a little bit of light on it, and I had a conversation with my attorney the other day, and this case came up. This was Thursday, March 3rd, that we had this conversation. Good, long conversation. We sat right here and talked for a good 5 hours about just everything kind of related to our case, the school cases, his 15 or so that the Iron Pigs ruling was included. First, our argument, and then, of course, was amended come January 13th. That ruling from Judge Hunter was then included with everything moving forward, including the Comstock case that we're going to talk about real quick. But what I wanted to illuminate was throughout this process, we've seen a lot of, you know, I don't really know what to qualify it as. There's lots of different terms, you know, corruption, hanky-panky, just hanky stuff happening. This is, to me, this is kind of a big deal, and it's kind of out in the open now. And the reason why I mentioned the conversation we had with David the other day is this is his case. Some stuff happened last week, and he said, well, you know, there's some irregularities happening here with this judge. He allegedly is getting all of these cases directed towards him, whether they're mask mandates or school mandates or health department cases. I think maybe there was some kind of internal memo or something that said that Judge Alexander Lipsey was going to get mostly these cases.
Which, to anybody watching right now, that should be flag number one. And that should really be a flag that any judge would say, I'm taking all of these cases.
I've been trying to find out if this is any kind of standard practice or if there's any kind of regulation or rule or MCR or something that says that he cannot do this. Again, I don't know. This stuff is all just kind of new to us, and we're figuring out exactly what that process looks like.
Yeah.
Maybe it was in an unofficial capacity. I don't know. But anyways, this judge, Judge Lipsey, has kind of been missing in action for a while around, I think there's 8 or 9 judges in the Comstock, that Kalamazoo area, whatever circuit that is.
So Judge Lipsey took a little hiatus while there was several cases pending.
So this happens usually when, judges aren't expected to be, on the job 52 weeks out of the year. So when these things happen, the state court, what was it? What do they call it? SCAO?
SCAO, State Court Admin Office.
State Court Admin Office, yeah.
They reassigned a judge.
They do these things. They'll bring they'll reassign these things, minor details for cases that need to be updated. My understanding is if there's a big deal or a big development in the case, this subsequent judge that SCAO appoints wouldn't make those big decisions, at least not with consulting with the original judge.
Which, and it's worth pointing out, too, that in the Let Them Breathe lawsuit, which was another one of Dave's lawsuits, the state implied that Dave was attempting to judge shop, which has been a term that's been used a lot lately, because Lipsey was not available. They accused him or were implying that he was trying to judge shop to make this happen. It wasn't Dave's call to issue another judge.
Right.
It was this administrative office that
right.
did so.
And that's my understanding, is that's why there are rules in place to keep anybody from judge shopping. That's why my understanding is that they assign cases on a random basis like this to keep
rotating.
That sort
yeah.
of thing from happening, or to try and get, what you might qualify as a favorable judge for your case. it seems like something has happened here in this particular case. So it gets assigned to Judge Lightfoot, and on February 23rd, she issues, let me get rid of some of this junk here. So Judge Lipsey originally gets the complaint. It gets shuffled over to Judge Lightfoot because Alexander is on, Judge
Lipsey is on my...
Lipsey is... on vacation, or it doesn't really matter what he's doing. I mean, he's entitled to a vacation. Great. So while he's gone, it gets pushed over to. There's a request for a ex parte temporary restraining order against Comstock Public Schools for a mask mandate. That's what this is all about: is a K-12 mask mandate in the Comstock Public Schools on behalf of 4 parents of minor children against Comstock Public Schools. Now, this is an ex parte temporary restraining order that was filed February 23rd.
By Judge Lightfoot. And we talked about the fact that the temporary restraining order was issued in roughly 4 hours after the ruling. So we have a sitting judge that made a ruling and happened to be in Dave's favor, which should eliminate it. But here's where it really gets interesting.
So a couple of things to point out before we get to the couple of the juicy parts of this, if you will. This is a big deal. Was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it still is a big deal. So this is the first time that a non-delegation argument has been used or successfully used in a mask, in a child K-12 mask mandate case. Our non-delegation was successful for 2253 as it relates to the shutdown of our restaurant and combating the health department's fine. So this is a big deal. This is the first judge to take into consideration that it also, the school code portion of it, which is, I think, is a 380s or something like that, as far as the MCLs go, to rule saying that the school court portion also is a violation of non-delegation.
Correct.
That's a big deal. That's what they had been fighting for. That's what we had originally been fighting for as well.
Which knocks down basically the policy for anybody else moving forward.
Right. So the next thing that we look at here when we're talking about this case is the fact that you've got Judge Lightfoot comes in, 23rd. She takes and orders this order shall remain in full force and effect, violates the non-delegation clause. And what's very interesting about this is they usually put a date on these temporary restraining. That's why they're called temporary, right?
Correct.
For an X amount of time, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days.
Which is typically to give time to allow proper hearings and procedures to take place.
Right. This order is set to last, was set to last until April 1st of 2023. So she didn't just say, hold on, we're going to put the brakes on this for 30, 60 days.
Let's give it a year.
She said, no. It's a year. So that's the 23rd. 2 days later, less than 2 days later, in comes Judge Lipsy.
Guess who's back?
Back again. So he finds out that Judge Lightfoot
ruled on his case.
Entered a temporary restraining order against a public health, a public school system.
And can you guess what Judge Lipsy did?
So Judge Lipsy took it upon himself to enter an order granting the defendant's motion to set aside orders or in the alternative for reconsideration of the entry of a temporary restraining order. So a couple of things stick out in this. So basically, one judge entered a temporary restraining order and granted a temporary restraining order. 2 days later, another judge comes along and says, nope, we're going to vacate that. That would be the equivalent of Judge Mertz in our district up here vacating Judge Hunter's ruling 2 days after. So that.
And to me, that's huge. You and I have talked about this at great lengths. I mean, the implications are endless. To think that a sitting judge can be overruled and the ruling overturned just based on the whim of another judge.
Which is why I'd like to see or get more evidence of any kind of internal order or memo granting him the authority to look at all these cases.
To this point, between the two of us, we haven't found it.
And or for him to have the authority to vacate this other judge's restraining order, temporary restraining order. The other thing that should be questioned is in here it says, so the matter coming before the court on the defendant's motion to set aside orders or in the alternative for reconsideration on the 23rd, temporary restraining orders, the court having read the briefs, having heard arguments on the defendant's motion, and being fully apprised of the premises. Now I'm going to submit to you right now, it is my understanding that there have not been arguments heard.
No.
And if it was not in the proper forum in a public hearing.
No, from what it reads is Judge Lipsy literally came back from wherever he was at and didn't like the fact that another judge made a ruling on a case that was originally his, even though it was reassigned. Now, again, think of the implications of a judge can overturn another judge. I mean,
So they ended up setting this for an emergency hearing, which was, I believe it happened the 28th.
And again, we don't know if this is a party foul or if there is some way somewhere that grants him the legal authority, but it sure does stink like hell.
We tried to go back and look at to see if some of the Zoom footage was still available on their YouTube channels. It doesn't look like it is, but
so
my understanding, and we're going to look and see, try to get maybe some transcripts from that hearing. But my understanding is that Judge Lipsy did not address the issue of him entering an order on top of
another judge's ruling.
He basically blew right past it as if it were never even brought to attention.
And again, think of the implications if that's allowed.
My understanding is that And I don't mean to speak out of turn or for anybody else, but I'm pretty sure that these folks are going to appeal or do something else and refile in some fashion.
Oh, could you imagine, though? I mean, hey, you got in trouble? Oh, don't worry. I got a buddy that's a judge. We'll take care of that.
So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we've got Judge Lipsy to start, right? He's on vacation, so Scow sends it over to Judge Lightfoot. She enters the temporary restraining order. 2 days later, Judge Lipsy finds out about the order and decides to rescind that order going forward.
Doesn't really seem like a legit process. But again, we don't know. We're not lawyers. It just really reeks.
It's something that we want to bring attention to. And again, we're not investigative journalists. We're not attorneys. We're not
don't
any of that.
Be.
We just happen to be party to some of these things. And it
we
just
have
just
me
reeks.
Two dicks with mics.
We've seen some sketchy things happening throughout all of this, you know, behind the scenes and Zoom hearings. You never know who all these attorney generals are speaking with in the background. You know, I don't have any evidence of it, but it'd be very easy for somebody to have another screen setting aside. And a couple of these judges that we've sat in front of have actually asked people when they come and they testify, you know, you only have the screen in front of you and the documents you're needed.
Yeah.
You don't have anybody else.
Is there anyone else
screens
in the room with you?
You're not getting. And I wish that were kind of the norm across the board, but you know, maybe it will be moving forwards. And so many of these things are in Zoom hearings now.
Well, hopefully we'll go back to actually doing things in person again.
Right. Well, we'll see. Apparently COVID is over now.
Oh no, no, it's not. It's not, because you got a comment last night. It's not over.
Oh yeah. Might as well bring up the Yerp review while we're at
it. Yeah. Miranda Budd from Roscommon, Michigan.
I wish this were comic relief. This one just really isn't. This one's more like just disgusting.
So, disclosure. These words are not mine, Ian's, or anybody else's. But it's an indication of just how rancid people are.
I got to be honest. I'll punch a mofo in their face if they were ever to say that to me. Even to anybody else in front of me.
No, this is
that,
a word that's not
that word
used.
Like that.
I mean, it's been long.
You can call me a lot of other things, or anybody else around me for that matter, but this one.
So Miranda Budd sent a message from your business profile, fucking retarded for not having your mask on. So clearly Miranda doesn't realize that it's
But crossed out the F word part of it.
The fucking part.
So.
But you're a pretty despicable person. Just
I don't know.
Throw it out there.
I don't know.
Oh, by the way, she called here.
Yes, this is one. So
we referenced it
in one of our earlier podcasts, like just an episode or two ago, a person that was calling here on the daily multiple times. So we started calling her back, kind of prank calling her. We've referenced that before. And I must have just manifested it. And or she just all of a sudden found Google, because that was where she was a Google review that she left, I think.
And by the way, before we get too far off subject, did you ever get a call back referencing the Ukrainian relief fund?
No.
Damn.
I did not. Unfortunately, no.
I guess
if you don't know
over.
What we're talking about, you have to go back and watch what,
guess you're not going
the last
over.
Episode 8. I can't keep track anymore.
I don't know where we're at anymore.
So anyway, so the reason why we wanted, another reason why we wanted to bring up the Comstock case, beyond the fact that our attorney was involved, our case is cited in it, our win is cited in that, unconstitutional.
Yeah.
The other day we got another filing, this time on behalf of, I gotta get these things right, sorry for the paper shuffling, but
I was saying there's so much going on,
so
like,
March,
where are you next?
March 4th we got another filing from the Attorney General's office, Dana Nessel, and our buddy Darren.
Is that the one that was cited in the Detroit News?
This is the one that they cited in the Detroit News. Yes. Yeah.
Which was a good read.
I encourage anybody to find it.
It was great advertising for you and the restaurant.
Aren't they always?
Those are great.
Thank you, Detroit News. Yeah, that was a pretty good write-up. Not that most of them aren't, but a few of them are.
But, you know, it was interesting because it's like all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, it's been going on the whole time, but Dana in her office seemed to think that the poor little Iron Pig restaurant is creating such mass chaos and confusion and irreparable harm statewide and withholding authority and power from the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah.
But for good reason.
It's interesting to me when they use the words confusion a lot in these proceedings. And going through, we've gone through in the last year plus, I kind of understand your confusion. You guys don't seem to get any of this. The 1945 that you used and abused so badly that it was found unconstitutional.
Well, and you know,
the 2253 you abused so badly, it also was found unconstitutional.
Well, and even like the NRA questions that were used to get rid of the Emergency Powers Act.
So clarity is not your guys' thing there, health
no.
department.
What did you
governor,
call it? An errant
Attorney
aberration
General.
That distorted Michigan's non-delegation doctrine is now being referenced in other legal challenges to state pandemic rules, Nestle's office argued in February filing. So she's even trying to go back 18 months now.
Yes.
To the NRA questions where the Emergency Powers Act was revoked to say that what a huge mistake that was. And if that was a huge mistake, then obviously Judge Hunter's ruling was a huge mistake.
Right.
And everything going forward is a huge mistake. And mean barbecue man can't get away with this.
We've known, and I say we, David, our attorney and I, we have known since the ruling came out that they would take any chance they could get to relitigate the NRA certified mm-hmm. questions. Thankfully, the 1945 is no longer part of law that it cannot be used. Doesn't mean that they don't want to go back and try and relitigate and recertified questions, because they fundamentally believe that it has changed the non-delegation clause in the state of Michigan.
As it has, as it should. I mean, because as we've stated time and time again, you have three branches of government. There's only one that makes law.
Right.
And that's not executive or judicial.
Right.
And they keep trying to say, no, we still have that ability. No, we still have that power. We still have that power. And, you know, for those of us, those of you that keep hearing us talking about NRA certified questions, those are basically the questions that were asked. Does the governor have the authority to do these things? To which, obviously, the answer was no from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's a great, the ruling in that by the Supreme Court in October of 2020, it's a nice long ruling and very well put, and it does further define the non-delegation clause. You know, there's non-delegation doctrine and non-delegation clause. One is the actual clause in our Constitution. The other is the idea of what non-delegation represents, right, which you just said. Mm-hmm. And this filing, they're including four new cases that are using the non-delegation doctrine as it relates to either us and or NRA certified questions. It's basically the same thing, because our argument in Wynn was built on NRA certified questions from 2020. We should have to take a drink every time we say certified questions.
Yeah.
So
we said a lot.
What's interesting about anything you want to say on the Detroit News article? I see you scrolling through that.
I'm still just chuckling. Yeah, I just missed it. It was dangerous. And that it destabilized an important source of public health protections presently needed by our most vulnerable residents. That was cited in the application of the Supreme Court. That Judge Hunter's ruling was just that dangerous.
Yes. So dangerous. So here's a brief in support of that theory, that it is a very confusing thing that certified questions has brought about. So the Comstock Schools case is cited in there. As well as three others, not all involving public schools, a health department as well. But basically what they're trying to say is that this is just wreaking havoc on our court system. Look what it's doing. It's causing so much confusion.
Well, and that was the next part I found. Nestle's office cited the conclusion as evidence of the mischief caused by the October 2nd, 2020 decision, and warned that the ruling would be misused as a tool of judicial overreach to usurp executive and legislative powers under the guise of preserving the separation.
So hidden inside that is basically how these people feel about due process. Because that's what is unfolding with these cases and all of these other, the vaccine mandate cases, the face mask in the schools, our case, they're all about the mandates and that were used under 2253.
It's all about control.
And they basically are saying, no, look at all this due process that's happening all over the place. We can't have that.
No, and they're asking that the courts not do their job. I mean, and this is the best one, is that, you know, so long as this court leaves it be, the more harm it will do, the more laws that will be undermined by it, the more courts that will misuse or be misled by it, and the more dysfunction that it will create for our democracy and institutions. For the sake of our state's non-delegation doctrine, as well as public health, a definitive fix is needed now. Nothing has happened other than due process being put back on top of things and following the steps that were laid out.
The problem is that in that statement, there are two fixes.
Mm-hmm.
One was the Supreme Court ruling that in recertified questions that the 1945 Emergency Powers of the Governor Act unconstitutional. The other is the January 13th, 2022 ruling from Judge Hunter, ruling 2253 unconstitutional. Those are the two fixes.
Yeah, which again, anybody please take your phone, take your tablet, take your laptop, and look up this MCL, just like Michigan MCL, and you'll see just how much of an overreach based on a three-paragraph MCL, one paragraph, which is actually applicable, how much overreach there was. It's just insane. And the fact that they're fighting so strongly to hold on to that control.
So two things have stood out when we're talking about a lot of this with regards to blindness and the idea that they need to hold on to control so badly that they are making terrible mistakes. We've talked about them before in our previous podcast. Our friends at the Senate and the House of Representatives pointed out some deep flaws in the state's arguments moving towards appeals. The other one that I find really troubling, so this is Dana Nessel and Darren Fowler's motion to include these four cases that we've been talking about. The Comstock, to bring it around, the Comstock case that we talked about, and the judge shopping that happened.
Lightfoot.
The one thing that I forgot to tell you about is we found out that apparently it is incredibly difficult to get a hold of Judge Lightfoot out of this office.
Really?
So when David Delaney called back to speak with Judge Lightfoot
to find out why
about Judge Lipsy entering this order, mainly to get a scheduling conflict figured out, because I think the state's attorney had a scheduling conflict, so he was calling. The clerk's office would not allow him to speak with Judge Lightfoot.
And to
this for whatever point, reason. And he could not get in contact with the judge and that issued the temporary restraint, ex parte temporary restraining order in his favor. They directly routed him to Judge Lipsy's office.
And I'm going to guess to this day, he still has not heard from Judge Lightfoot.
I cannot confirm that, but I made the joke to him the other day. I was like, he's not very savvy on Facebook, but I made the joke. I'm like, why try and find her on Facebook Messenger?
Well, the funny thing is, and I think you're getting ready to go there with this, is in the brief that Dana Nessel filed, she actually cites the quote-unquote confusion
between
George Lipsy and Lightfoot and how two judges can interpret things two different ways. So she's citing as a basis for the Supreme Court to get involved the chaos that Judge Lipsy created, which presumably, again, we don't know for sure, presumably was intended for a specific reason, to keep the whole mask mandate bullshit and everything else in effect, and to not expose any vulnerability on behalf of the state and the Health and Human Services.
And maybe some of these things are allowable and are on the up and up, but when you start to look at the totality of these things that are going on, you know, we joke about the swamp, but I mean, this seems like just really, really swampy.
I mean, how many times a day do we look at each other and go, you can't make this shit up? I mean, you can't.
Seriously. So this is the attorney general and an assistant attorney general citing the Comstock case. And in here, again, they're talking about the confusion that it's bringing about. In here, they cite the allegations invoked both certified questions and the circuit court's opinion here. One circuit court judge granted a temporary restraining order, Lightfoot, One circuit court granted a temporary restraining order on non-delegation grounds, but another judge subsequently set the order aside for further proceedings. they're citing their own judge shopping.
Yeah. Acknowledging the judge shopping.
As it looks. So that to me just kind of reeks.
And again, just think about what the world could be if a judge can just step in and go, yeah, I don't think so. Not so much. Let's flip that around.
Yeah.
Imagine whether it's, you know, divorce proceedings or, you know, drunk driving or, God forbid, domestic violence or anything like that. To be able to have a judge step in and go, yeah, I think you missed the boat on that, Ian. I'm just going to overturn that.
Yeah.
That just doesn't seem right.
If anything is going to sow confusion, wouldn't that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that when, you know, take your case originally, as where it stands right now, that DHHS disagreed with Judge Hunter's ruling, then it immediately goes to the Court of Appeals. When you go past one, which is one judge ruling, go to the Court of Appeals, you are, in essence, then appealing to a board. No longer one judge, a board.
Mm-hmm.
And that board comes to consensus as to whether, you know, your appeal was founded or no. But, you know, they don't realize that's the process. So we're just going to skip past them up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Which will bring us to our next topic we need to talk about. I mean, it's another pat on the back for due process.
They're not. It doesn't seem like they're really big fans of due process. So we're working on.
They don't like losing. I don't think they like losing at all.
Well, they definitely don't like losing. I mean, especially when you've got as much money and the cadre of attorneys that they have access to. That's just state, you know, state's attorneys. You know what I mean?
You know, so, you thought organized crime was bad. Some of the shit that we've read.
To me, and I'm learning more since I have been asking questions of some of our state representatives. I'm finding out that there are a lot of things that are just really kind of disgusting in the whole process that I could never get into politics. I mean, I don't have the mouth for it, for one, because I would just be running it all the time.
No, but we can't lie as much as is required.
It's
we have no filter.
It's extremely swampy.
Yeah, so, you know, and we've had some people that have told us some things that they're kind of mind-blowing, but they're like, you know, we can't put it out there.
Yeah.
There's too much blowback.
We're working on a couple of things that I think pale, you make this pale in comparison.
And folks, this is not conspiracy theory bullshit. This is legitimate public record. I mean, it's we have a stack of paper this thick. I mean, we're not making this stuff up.
In my opinion, and I, you would probably agree with me on this, but in my opinion, in the public meetings that I've gone to recently, a lot of these people don't like being questioned on some of the decisions that they're making, and they have a hard time with that. But what I'm really finding out is that they don't like the process as it is unfolding now. They like the process as it was before, when it was kind of just,
when it was unchecked,
kind of
power,
like ships passing in the night. There was nobody showing up to public meetings, so it was very easy to get things done, and nobody was questioning.
Because nobody, like we admitted, I mean, we didn't know or give two shits about the health department board or the health department meetings until this all happened. Do your job in the background. Just, you do you. Just don't bother us. Well, until people start making decisions that affect and influence all of our livelihoods and outcomes.
Right.
I mean, all the 3,000 restaurants, what, 3,000?
Yeah.
3,000 restaurants and, you know, bars that went out of business because of shit that's now being deemed unconstitutional. I mean, there's got to be consequences. And right now it feels like they're fighting awfully hard to avoid any kind of consequences.
They need to be talking about next time.
Yeah, and that's what this is all about, is what's not going to happen.
Because the first go-round is gone. The second go-round is gone, right? They're both unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. All they have left is the correct application of the Emergency Management Act. And they better start getting those processes figured out now before we have to go through this nonsense again and they start using power in a way that, it wasn't meant to.
Bring Serpico back out of retirement.
Serpico. So that was going to say, we're working on that video, our in-house security footage of that right now, which is, again, very illuminating when it comes to the due process.
Which, by the way, I appreciate you sending that to me. I mean, I really enjoy getting to watch it because it really... Yeah.
So the last thing that we're going to talk about here is another filing. This is an amicus curiae. I'm finding out how to pronounce all of these words. I don't know Latin.
The amicus. Shit.
So amicus, I was calling amicus. Amicus curiae, front of the court briefing by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy.
Which, by the way, has nothing to do with Mackinac City, Mark. Mark, our producer. Not Mackinac City.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. I was just going to say, they are, to put their credentials out there a little bit, they're a nonpartisan group that basically is there to preserve checks and balances, to make sure that nobody oversteps their bounds and there's accountability on all levels. I mean, they look at all cases and they're completely neutral.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, this is their wheelhouse, if you will, and they are the party that was at the Supreme Court in 2020
for the NRA certified questions.
For NRA certified questions, which is the main reason why they filed this front of the court brief. They have significant interest in the outcome, so they decided, since they have tons of knowledge, obvious knowledge in certified questions, they chimed in. And it's a little bit different than the
House
find
and
the
Senate.
Correct page. Than the House and Senate, which is appreciated.
Well, and you and I talked about this earlier. I want to point out too, on your behalf, a huge thank you to the Department of Health and Human Services, because had they not skipped the appellate court, these amicus briefs would not be allowed.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, so the fact that they decided to skip the appellate court process has since allowed the House and the Senate, and now the Mackinac.
So we have some pretty big supporters, if you will, and we'll use that in quotation marks. They are briefing as friends of the court, just as extra advisors, if you will.
Which anytime you hear the term amicus briefs or amicus briefs, as we called them before, it's basically somebody chiming in as a friend of the court to offer their opinion and cite legal precedents.
Right. And the Senate and the House of Representatives did last week or 2 weeks ago. They're blown by so fast I can't keep track. So, you know, they represent the third branch of government. So they are
the only one that's allowed to make laws.
Right. And they're a great partner to have going forward on this.
Mm-hmm.
The next best that we could ask for would be the Mackinac Center, because they litigated these same attorneys that are on the front of this motion, on the front of this brief, are the same folks that argued in front of the state Supreme Court in these exact same questions.
Yeah, and it's not nonpartisan, not a far right leaning organization. I mean, if you look at their
track, free markets.
Yeah.
You mean, go to their website and they just talk about free markets and the application of the Constitution, and that's their big thing, is making sure that everybody stays in their lane. And they had a big ruling in 2020 that slapped the executive branch back into their lane, and in my opinion, probably it didn't work. Also, my opinion, kind of should have woke up the legislative branch. They didn't. It took a petition drive to ultimately get the 45 to go down, and I understand why it did. But.
Well, and you know, even going back to like Nestle's motion to try to have the Emergency Powers Act, that ruling overturned. I mean, it's irrelevant because a petition actually went through, and it's been removed.
Right.
So even if she gets the Supreme Court to, you know, change the ruling on the Emergency Powers Act, it still can't come back because it's gone.
Gone.
It's done.
Gone.
It's done. It's no longer 1945. We now have the Mackinac Bridge. We have cell phones. We have communication. It's irrelevant. Eradicated.
They can attempt to try. That's a double whatever. They can try and change the outcome of NRE certified questions, but it will not change the outcome of the emergency powers of the
government. No,
45 as well.
Yeah. Petition signed, done, gone.
So essentially, they may Mackinac Center makes 3 points, saying
you've heard this before, by the way.
This appeal is a flawed vehicle through which to address the viability of NRE certified questions. Two, there is no urgent necessity that justifies short-circuiting the ordinary appellate process.
Which the House and Senate agreed with.
And three, granting the bypass application would likely foster an unwarranted politicized view of the court.
Which we've basically said that all along. The House and the Senate agreed with mostly the same points. That, you know, the reason they're going back at it is we feel, and obviously House, Senate, and the Mackinac feel that they're going back because the powers have shifted on the Supreme Court. Judge shopping.
Yeah. So these are pretty well stated. Not very long. But
no, right to the point.
Very to the point. You know, here, as has been noted elsewhere, the department failed to preserve its argument that INRI certified questions should be reversed. We've said that for a while.
Well, and the House and Senate, with their amicus brief, actually said that, you know, the state did not address their central issue.
They even go on to make, you know, their second point under the first argument is that their own reasoning, their own application gives a host of reasons why a ruling on the viability of INRI certified questions is not necessary. So they're kind of saying, well, they're kind of arguing against themselves on that one. The second point, there is no urgent necessity that justifies short-circuiting the ordinary appellate process.
Again, House and Senate said the same thing. You can't skip steps. You don't like Judge Hunter, file a motion with the Court of Appeals and wait the outcome.
I always say everything's in the language that they use, right? So here, right off the bat, Mackinac Center says, despite the department's overwrought rhetoric.
What? Rhetoric?
Imagine that.
They use rhetoric?
The analysis in INRI certified questions does not oppose any urgent threat to the balance of powers in the Senate, although the department cites several pending cases posing various non-delegation claims. That's the four cases that we were talking about, mm-hmm. One including the Comstock school case. So they're saying, look at all this harry-carry that is being committed because of INRI certified questions. Not just the Iron Pig case. I love that it's referred to that by the way.
Free advertising again. Thanks, Dana. But, you know, I'm so hung up on rhetoric because I thought the only thing they used was your Facebook page.
It's true. If it's on Facebook, you know it's true.
It's got to be.
Their investigative processes were pathetic at best, to be honest.
They're shameful. We've talked about it on other episodes, but like, again, even personally, so far as to sit there and have some asshole recording my family while we were here eating.
Yeah.
I'm sure you work for the state of Michigan, whoever you are, but I would love to meet you face to face again because that was just absolutely absurd.
Yeah. As most of it is.
And again, he didn't know me from Adam. I'm not Ian Murphy.
Of course not.
I'm just stuck being your damn neighbor. Look what I get drawn into.
Stop changing my light bulbs in my house, Chris. Obviously,
never.
That's an inside joke. So, along with this argument, they go on to further state, along with there really being no crisis, other than these four cases that they're trying to prove is the crisis of the non-delegation argument. They're also saying that nor is there any reason to suspect that this particular case will substantially reorient the Michigan's non-delegation jurisprudence.
But it was literally a matter of days that they skipped from Hunter to Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. It's not like they even sat and waited around for a week or so to see, you know, what the appellate court did. They literally just leapfrogged everybody. Again, there was no reason for them to do that because the Mackinac Center also addresses the fact that there's no immediate impact to anybody or anything in the state of Michigan right now that would warrant such a leapfrog.
Yep.
I mean, nobody's house is going to burn down.
That's basically what the rest of this portion goes on to say, despite this emergency and this crisis with regards to non-delegation. I would argue the due process that is unfolding for some of these folks. You know, we talked, you know, off air about the Sheboygan case up there as well. That had to do with quarantine and not proper notice given under a different statute.
Which, again, you know, if you follow this, goes back to like the Ingham County case where they addressed what proper process was the entire time as far as serving notice. And in that case, again, it was another win for process.
Oh, also to be noted, the need for exigent rulings related to the pandemic has also dissipated. The department rescinded the large majority of its pandemic-related orders almost 9 months ago on June 17, 2021, and has never reinstated them since.
But they're still fighting.
Federal decision makers have followed the same trend. For example, according to the CDC's guidance on February 25th, 2022, the CDC assesses that almost 90% of Americans no longer need to wear facial coverings.
And I do believe they also cited SCOTUS in there in regards
they
to...
They do. They go on to... Right here they talk about in January... Right around the same, actually, is the same day that our ruling came out. January 13th was a big deal.
When Biden's
have
vaccine
have an
mandate was
celebration
down.
On that day.
Yeah,
yeah, they struck down OSHA's vaccine mandate.
With exceptions, but still, big one.
So the third point that the Mackinac Center for Public Policy is making to the Supreme Court, telling them that it should be at least kicked back down to the Court of Appeals. They're saying, number three, granting the bypass application would likely foster an unwarranted politicized view of the court.
You think?
And this is the one where we talk about all the time, and it's hard not, they kind of co-mingle with each other, but this is the one where we talk about in 2020, October 2020, it was four conservatives to three
liberal
justices in our state Supreme Court.
And now here we are the other way.
And now it's kind of flipped around. The other way.
And the damage, I mean, I agree with both amicus briefs, is that how can you still have faith in our judicial system if a year and a half later you want to overturn the previous ruling?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to make sense or hold water to me in any way, shape, or form. No different than it does to me in the Comstock case, where how can you step in and just simply overturn and not expect people to see it as political?
So this, to me, is where when we talk about what happened or is happening in Comstock with the Judge Lipsy issue down there and that case, I look at that. I look at some of the things that happened in our cases. And then and some of our, like, Let Them Breathe, mm-hmm. the case we have not talked about a whole lot, but I'm sure that we will more.
Yep, we got some guests coming on for
this,
that.
So this one is kind of a big deal. This is where politics really start coming into play. And unfortunately, it has come into play with these overreaching unconstitutional orders that they keep using. So they go on to state in this third and final point, and I'm just going to read most of this because it's pretty spot on. Granting the bypass application and overruling Inri certified questions so soon after it was decided would also unnecessarily harm the public perception of this court. As the department observes, the Inri certified questions was issued in a fractured period of time in Michigan politics, but it would only exacerbate this state's fractured polity? I don't know that word. To short-circuit the ordinary appellate process, grant leave to review without any compelling necessity to do so, and overrule what is perhaps the most widely publicized decision of this court in the last several decades. Adherence to stare decisis, which we haven't talked a whole lot about stare decisis, and then it should be more Latin, and it basically just means leave it alone.
Yeah, just
leave it be. As it has been decided, Let it be. So is decided something like that. Adherence to stare decisis is particularly appropriate where there are strong reliance on interests. That is where the previous decision has become so embedded, so accepted, so fundamental to everyone's expectations that to change it would produce not just readjustments, but practical real-world dislocations. They cite a couple of cases in here. Although the department claims that few people have relied upon Inri certified questions due to its relatively recent vintage, this court's decision in certified questions had significant and immediate practical effects for every Michigan citizen as soon as it was decided. We know this.
Yep.
When Inri certified questions was decided, the governor's pandemic-related executive orders, which touched many facets of everyday life for every Michigan resident, was invalidated.
It would be a shock to many Michigan citizens to discover that only 18 months after INRI certified questions, the issue of the governor's pandemic-related authority was back on the table once more. When this court has previously declined to apply stare decisis and overruled recent precedent, it did not contribute positively to the public perception of the court. Again, a couple of more courts precedent in here. Moreover, on previous occasions in which the court changed its mind after its composition changed, the legal issues were relatively opaque to the general public. The ruling in INRI certified questions, by contrast, is one of the most significant decisions that the court has issued in decades, and it had an immediate effect on every citizen as soon as it was decided. If it is overruled less than 2 years after it was decided, many members of the general public will seize upon the fact that the composition of the court has changed in the interim. The perception that the law of this state depends upon the composition of the court will have unfortunate consequences for the public's perception to the institutional legitimacy of the court. To the extent that the department is trying to obtain a reversal of INRI certified questions simply because the composition of the court has changed in the interim, any such motivation underestimates this court's commitment to the rule of law.
Which, how could it not? I mean, because obviously, if the court was still the same, you would expect the same decision.
Yeah.
So, you and I both know that there'd be no way that they would appeal to the Supreme Court if it was the same makeup, because it was the same court that had already ruled. So, to ask for a redo is absurd, because, again, keep everybody in the loop. So, when the Emergency Powers Act was struck down and yanked, that's when the governor, because she had no power now, gave the Health and Human Services Department the reins and said, go do my bidding.
The very next day.
Which brought about 2253 and your fight, with that being unconstitutional. So, again, they've stepped, been pulled back. Stepped, been pulled back. And every time they get told no, they keep trying to find a way to throw in a, yeah, but.
Yeah,
and right. Now we have two huge bodies. You know, the brief from the House and Senate and then the Mackinac amicus.
Yep.
Both saying, hey, you know, looking at the Supreme Court saying, don't do this. You can't. Because it's going to cause way too many waves. And again, this is the people that brought you follow the science. Well, now, as things have progressed, they don't want to agree with the science that they preach, that, you know, you're fighting a losing battle.
Yeah.
I mean, COVID's not going anywhere. And again, we don't care about vaccines or masks. It's about following due process and the constitutionality of what
they've
tried to do.
That's what we're saying now, that the science hasn't changed, only the political science has.
Yep, which I like that quote.
TM.
Yep.
All of this stuff added together is, it's tough to look at individually and get so far down into some of the stuff. When you take a step back and you look at everything that's going on and how politics has been so injected into this, the local level, the state level,
and even right here, we've seen it between, you know, school board and you know, county commissioners and the health department board, and how divisive and how angry some people are. But, you know, it's, to me, at what point do they stop fighting a losing battle? I mean, it's almost a moot point now.
Right. That's my plea to the most of them, whether they're Board of Health members, county commissioners. You know, we've had plenty of state representatives, a couple of governor candidates come through here. And you fundamentally cannot affect any change if you just automatically write off half of the electorate.
Yeah.
You've got to figure out a way to have a conversation and caucus with them. And my thing is, why don't we just all start from a position of, we all got it wrong.
Yeah, it was a mess.
We didn't know. We all got it wrong. Let's start from there and figure out that these are the tools we still have left in our toolkit if something like Corona comes.
And what do we do
again
next time?
And how do we handle it? And who's responsible? And if somebody's going to issue a mandate, how is that going to fall within the ideals of separation and non-delegation and James Madison's ideas of how we are supposed to separate those powers, and elected officials make the decisions, and holding hired administrators accountable when they're not elected.
And I think we learned that, you know, one or two people should not have the authority, period, which again has been the basis of everything we've been talking about with the removal of the Emergency Powers Act, with 2253. It all comes down to no one or two people or entity, which I think is mentioned in the House and Senate brief, that nobody should have that power.
INRI Certified Questions does a great job because they actually look at the non-delegation clause and kind of as it relates to non-delegation doctrine, which is the overarching theme of separation. But they give it further definition. You know, there has to be time limits, which is what the EMA grants versus the emergency powers and even the 2253. There's no time limits. There's barely any definition.
And again, the 2253, there's nothing in there that even comes close to granting them the authority that they took. In the Emergency Powers Act, again, 1945, there was no Mackinac Bridge. I mean, that law made sense in 1945.
Well, and it had never been abused.
No, there was no cell phones, there was no...
It had never been abused so badly that it never needed to be questioned in the broad use as was this 1976 or 1978, I forget when the health code and that thing was particularly...
Yeah, oh, 76, yeah. Well, and you and I chuckled that even that 146 pages that Nestle filed, just how many absurd things that she cited in there that was just like, come on, just quit beating a dead horse.
They're throwing everything that they can at it. You know, they let Carl the Barber got away with one. They can't let the Mean Barbecue Man get away with one.
Did they include a picture of her hammered at Michigan?
No, they didn't.
They didn't?
I'm going to every time we submit something to their office now, though.
But I wish they would include that. They've thrown everything else at it, so might as well put a picture of her. Just
they could. Yeah. They got me in trouble. Twisted TV.
No pun intended. Pig face drunk.
Yeah, right.
At U of M Stadium.
We should name a Bloody Mary after her, or something like that. The day drunk Dana Bloody Mary.
The day drunk.
Make it like a quadruple Bloody Mary, or out of one of those funnels or something like that that you would
a
see.
Bomb.
A
fishbowl.
Yeah. Anyways, let's wrap it up for today, my brother. Thank you for hanging out,
my pleasure, as always. And Dana, we're looking forward to sending you an Iron Pig gift set, including gift cards, some swag, you know, so you can roll.
Yeah, wait till the FDN, #FDN merchandise drops. Because, you know, there is an election coming this year, and if we can anything, we're definitely going to help replace Dana Nestle. I'd like to replace the governor, too, and probably the Secretary of State. But
yeah, I think the governor's probably...
Dana Nestle's signature is on almost all of this paperwork of ours, so she's the top law enforcer in the state. So
I think you're going to see a whole lot of changes this year.
I think so, too. That's a discussion for another day, too, and probably some more guests that we're going to have on coming up soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We got a lot of fun guests coming up.
Yeah. Anyways, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you, as always. Thanks for joining us. Murphy's Law.